President Mohsen Rezai welcomed the statement as a basis for compromise between government and the opposition. And that's the latest BBC News.
You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC with Nkem Ifejika. Pakistan has been racked by violence in recent months, with the army mounting an offensive against Islamist militants near the Afghan border. And the militants responding with suicide bombings have killed hundreds of people. Today, near the town of Lucky Marwat, people were playing volleyball together when there was a huge explosion. More than 70 people are now thought to have died after a suspected suicide bomber drove a truck into the sports ground. Joining me from Islamabad in a moment will be Ali Maqbool. But first, before we go to that story, hundreds of new recruits to a hardline Islamist group in Somalia have paraded through the streets of the capital, Mogadishu. One of their leaders pledged to send them to Yemen to join the Islamist rebels who are fighting the Yemeni government. Yemen's government has said that up to 300 Al-Qaeda operatives may be using the country as a base. Jack Izzard reports on the Somali Islamists.
A show of strength and a portent of violence to come. As hundreds of foot soldiers from the Al-Shabaab militia paraded through Mogadishu, their message was clear. The Islamist group, which also showed off a fleet of trucks fitted with machine guns, has been fighting Somalia's transitional government for years. Now it plans to send its forces across the Gulf of Aden to fight in Yemen too. One of the group's leaders, Sheikh Mukhtar Robo Abu Mansur, had this message for Yemen's Islamist rebels.
You should know that with the help of God, we are your reinforcements. The fighters in Somalia are ready to cross this little sea that separates us and to help you with your struggle.
That struggle is only partly with Yemen's weak central government. The Yemeni insurgents, who have links to Al-Qaeda, are thought to be using the country as a base from which to fight a global jihad. Some of them claim to have been behind the plot to blow up an airliner over America on Christmas Day, and the alleged bomber is thought to have trained for his mission there. Yemen is fast becoming the center of gravity for Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, and the United States will soon double its military assistance to the country's government. The possible arrival of Al-Shabaab reinforcements there means the new year could be a bloody one.
Jack Izzard with that report. The failed bombing over Detroit on December 25th is continuing to have ramifications across several continents. At each airport where the Nigerian man stopped off, there's been soul searching by the authorities as to why he wasn't stopped. Now there's disagreement between Ghana and Nigeria. Nigeria says the alleged bomber, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, spent some time at the international airport in Ghana, but that's in dispute, as the BBC's West Africa correspondent, Casper Layton, reports.
A show of strength and a portent of violence to come. As hundreds of foot soldiers from the Al-Shabaab militia paraded through Mogadishu, their message was clear. The Islamist group, which also showed off a fleet of trucks fitted with machine guns, has been fighting Somalia's transitional government for years. Now it plans to send its forces across the Gulf of Aden to fight in Yemen too. One of the group's leaders, Sheikh Mukhtar Robo Abu Mansur, had this message for Yemen's Islamist rebels.
We apologize for that. That obviously wasn't Casper Layton. But we can go back to Ali Maqbool in Islamabad. We were talking about the story of the 70 people killed by a suicide car bomb in the northwest of the country. Ali, what's the latest on casualties? We said 70. What have you got so far?
Yes, well, the casualty number is varying. Some police are saying over 60, 61. Others are saying up to 75. We have heard from some emergency workers that the final death toll could be as much as 90. This all happened at a sports ground in a town called Lucky Marwat in northwest Pakistan. And what was happening was that there was a volleyball match going on at the time. Eyewitnesses say that well over 200 people were watching that match when a car was driven onto the ground and exploded as it hit a building at the side of where most of the spectators were sitting. So as well as spectators having been killed in the ground, dozens of them, also people have been killed because of the size of the blast. Houses in the nearby area were also destroyed, and so bodies are being found in the rubble there too.
I mean, do we know who carried out this attack? Have there been claims of responsibility, or have the authorities apportioned blame to some group?
There hasn't been a claim of responsibility as yet, but all fingers are being pointed at the Taliban for several reasons. I mean, this is a place very close to South Waziristan, which is where the Pakistani army's been carrying out a major offensive against Taliban militants. And the Taliban, for the last 3 months, have been carrying out what are seen as revenge attacks because of that operation. Also, some of those killed in this attack in Lucky Marwat were members of a peace committee. They'd just been having a meeting in a mosque next to the sports ground. Now, this peace committee is a group that was basically campaigning for an end to Taliban influence in the area. So some of those members of that committee being killed has also led people to feel it is the Taliban. And while the army has said that its operations in the tribal areas have gone very well, the feeling is that really militants have just left that, escaped the areas where the operations have been taking place and are regrouping elsewhere so they can still carry out attacks at will.
Thank you very much, Ali Makbul in Islamabad. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Still to come, Pope Benedict and the Archbishop of Canterbury have used their New Year messages to urge people to respond to the needs of others in distant countries and cultures.
In a world where risk and suffering are everybody's problem, the needs of our neighbours are the needs of the whole human family.
But first, a reminder of the main news. As you heard there in the item we covered, a suicide car bomb attack at a volleyball tournament in the northwestern region of Pakistan has killed more than 70 people. There's dismay and outrage in Iraq after a controversial case against 5 security guards accused of killing unarmed civilians in the country has been discontinued. 17 people were killed when the guards, employed by the Blackwater Company, opened fire in Baghdad in 2007. Now, in spite of the demands in Iraq for the men to face trial in Baghdad, they were returned to the US for justice. Now, an American judge has dropped the charges against them because of inadmissible evidence. Our correspondent Jim Mew in Baghdad reports.
The Iraqi government was outraged by the Blackwater incident in 2007. There's widespread public anger here too. Baghdad wanted the security men to face justice in Iraq itself. It's been watching proceedings in the US courts closely and has reacted furiously to the dismissal of the case. A government statement said it had begun preparations for taking court action against Blackwater for killing the 17 unarmed civilians. It also urged the U.S. Justice Department to appeal against the verdict and to cooperate in prosecuting the 5. The Blackwater shooting brought to a head public resentment here against the behavior of some private security companies. The top U.S. commander in Iraq, General Ray Odierno, feared the court decision might have negative repercussions for security companies still working here.
We all know it was not U.S. soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines who did this. It was a private security company. What I worry about is, will there be backlashes against private security companies that continue to operate here? And I wouldn't like to see that either.
The Blackwater incident helped bring about changes to the conditions under which the private security companies now work. They no longer enjoy immunity from prosecution, and they're subject to Iraqi law. In fact, a British security employee, Danny Fitzsimmons, is currently on trial here on charges of shooting dead 2 of his colleagues and injuring an Iraqi.
Jim Muir reporting from Baghdad. The Archbishop of Canterbury and Pope Benedict have used their New Year messages to urge people to respond to the needs of others in distant countries and cultures. Rowan Williams said that what had been in many ways a terrible and grueling decade had shown how the problems in any part of the world were quickly shared by the whole global community. The Pope said respect for others, regardless of their nationality or religion, was essential for world peace. Here's our religious affairs correspondent, Robert Piggott.
Rowan Williams delivered a bleak assessment of a decade beset by terrorism, war, natural disaster and financial collapse. However, speaking in a New Year message, Dr. Williams said these crises had taught us one enormous lesson, that we needed to take personal responsibility for alleviating the suffering of people, even if they lived in far-off countries. He called on people to treat the suffering of others overseas as if it were happening to a member of their own families.
Above all, it's about not losing our hope for change and our love and respect for the dignity of everyone. In a world where risk and suffering are everybody's problem, the needs of our neighbours are the needs of the whole human family. Let's respond just as we do when our immediate family is in need or trouble. We may be amazed by the difference we can make.
Pope Benedict also emphasized respect for people in other cultures in his traditional New Year's Day Mass, calling for people of different nationalities to be seen as brothers within humanity rather than rivals. The Pope also made a special plea for individuals to change their personal lifestyles to protect the environment.
Robert Piggott reporting. The price of vodka in Russia has more than doubled on Friday as the Russian government's tried to crack down on rampant alcoholism. Russia has one of the highest levels of alcohol consumption in the world. As our Moscow correspondent Richard Galpin explains, it's part of a plan by the Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, to try to reduce sales.
He started this program, in fact, a few months ago, and he's trying to promote a much healthier lifestyle for Russians because, of course, there is a huge problem of alcoholism in the country, and it seems to be getting worse. I mean, the statistics are really quite frightening. There's something like 35,000 at least. 35,000 people are dying every year from alcohol poisoning. The number of children drinking alcohols increasing. And indeed, there was an interesting piece of research done by the Lancet a couple of years ago in which they discovered that half of all deaths of men of working age in this country is because of alcohol abuse. And of course, there's a very serious problem here that the population is declining very rapidly. The average lifespan of men in Russia is just 59 years, and it's thought a lot of that is due to the fact that people drink so much alcohol.
Richard Galpin in Moscow. Well, under the new measures, the cost of a half-litre bottle will be at least $3, but legally produced vodka can be bought for half that price. These Moscow residents think high prices won't make any difference.
Those people who drank good vodka before will continue to drink good vodka, and those who have been poisoning themselves by drinking bad vodka will continue to do it. The new price fixing won't change anything.
People drank before and will continue to drink, and it doesn't matter how much it costs. The fact is that, unfortunately, the cheap vodka that was put on the market some time ago will become a bit more expensive now, and that's the only thing that will change.
Well, Professor David Deridze is the head of the Russian Cancer Research Center, and he's made a study of the devastating impact of alcohol consumption on his country. He says that attitudes of macho drinking culture need to change in Russia.
A lot of drinking is a sort of Russian lifestyle habit. I mean, in all social classes in Russia, people drink a lot. You know, it's a sign of being strong men, a sort of macho sort of lifestyle, and it needs to be changed. It needs education. People should be educated. People should understand that a lot of drinking kills not only one personalities, individuals, but it kills nations.
Professor David Deridze of the Russian Cancer Center. About 2 hours ago, the freed British hostage Peter Moore returned to the UK from Iraq. His flight was met at a Royal Air Force base in central England by Foreign Office staff who took him away for a private reunion with his family. Mr. Moore, who's 36, had been staying at the British Embassy in Baghdad since his release on Wednesday. Three of the four British security guards kidnapped with him were killed, and the fourth, Alan McMenemy, is also believed to be dead. This report by Angus Crawford.
Peter Moore spent last night at the British Embassy in Baghdad and was flown back into the UK on board an executive jet, which touched down briefly at Amman in Jordan before making the six-hour journey to RAF Brize Norton, where it arrived shortly after 5 o'clock. Within minutes of touching down, he stepped off the plane in a blue fleece top, cream trousers and a cap. He shook hands with a flight engineer and then boarded a people carrier flanked by officials to be reunited with his family at an undisclosed location. In a statement, they said, "We are thrilled to have Peter back safely. We have a lot of catching up to do and would like to have time with Peter on our own."
Angus Crawford with that report. I'm Nkem Ifejika. The headlines: a suicide car bomb attack at a volleyball tournament in the northwestern region of Pakistan has killed more than 70 people. And the Islamist group Al-Shabaab in Somalia says it's prepared to send fighters across the sea to Yemen to support Islamist militants there. You're listening to the BBC World Service.
I'm Jonathan Froon with the business news from the BBC. It's the start of a new year, which is always a good time to reflect on what might happen in the coming 12 months. To help us do that, we've two guests. Lionel Barber is the editor of the Financial Times newspaper, and Daniel Franklin edits The Economist's The World in 2010. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Daniel, briefly, what do you think are going to be the big business and economic stories of the coming year?
Well, I think the biggest issue is going to be what you might call letternomics. Which letter of the alphabet, V, U, WL is the economic recovery going to follow? Which pattern is it going to follow? And then China is the other country people will be looking at to see whether its extraordinary resilience continues or whether it's perhaps inflating the next bubble.
Well, we'll come back to some of those. But Lionel, in the meantime, what are you expecting to see in the coming year?
Well, Jonathan, you remember that famous phrase that President Clinton came out with in the 92 campaign, it's the economy, stupid. I would say in 2010, it's going to be, it's the balance sheet, stupid. Will households repair their balance sheets and banks and corporates? The second issue will be bankers or banksters. Will we get back to a bit of normality where the financial services sector is not treated as a pariah?
OK, well, let's go through some of those issues. Daniel, you started by talking about letonomics.
Well, W, first of all, is the one you don't want. That's where there's a double dip, which is a distinct possibility, I think, as one of the issues that policymakers have is how do you get out of the extraordinary stimulus that has been provided both in monetary and fiscal policy to stave off depression? Then there's a possibility of an L-shaped recovery where it just bumps along the bottom. A bit like Japan, that's, again, the model to be avoided, but it's a perhaps a rather worryingly real prospect for southern European countries in particular. And the V, more likely, I think, and that's what we have been seeing already in Asia, where it's a really strong rebound.
Lionel, do you think it's a W, a U, a V, an L, something else altogether?
I'm tempted to borrow the phrase used by Sir Martin Sorrell, which was an italic I, which is sort of something between an L and a V. And who said that decoupling was dead? That is to say that countries can grow almost independent of America, which has traditionally been the locomotive of growth. It does seem as though Asia has decoupled from America. Question, of course, is whether Chinese growth can replicate the kind of locomotive effect that America has. And my answer to that, I think, is no, because it's obviously much smaller compared to the enormous strength of the American economy.
Well, let's talk about China for a moment. This is obviously going to be absolutely critical for the coming years and for the whole nature of the global recovery. We last brought you two together around a year ago, and here's what you had to say about the country's economy against a backdrop of real economic uncertainty.
Most of the world will be in recession. The question is, will there be any bright spots? Can, for example, China pull out of a big slowdown in growth, say, by the end of the year? That might be a bright spot for all of us.
It could, but I think almost an equal possibility is that China struggles to cope very badly with what is a particularly sharp slowdown in its case, to the point that perhaps political stability might be in question.
Daniel, I take my hat off to you for giving us a 50-50 prediction of political instability in China, but what do you think is going on in the Chinese
economy? Well,
of course, China
did defy expectations. Lionel got it, I think, spot on. China was extraordinary in the way that it marshalled resources, had the mother of all stimulus programmes, and implemented it without the minor inconvenience of having to get it through Parliament or anything like that, incredibly quickly. And I think one of the reasons for that also was that it was worried about the political consequence if it did stall.
I think that's right. There is a phrase which I've just made up saying that there are lies and Chinese statistics. The fact is, though, that I interviewed Premier Wen Jiabao in January 2009, and he said we probably will get to 8% growth. And that's what they've done. They've actually excelled that. There are, though, questions about the quality of this recovery. It's very infrastructure-based, public works program. There's not enough consumer-driven growth. It's all driven down with infrastructure. Therefore, you are still getting the kind of global imbalances between a China that's saving too much, that wants to preserve its exchange rate tied to the dollar, and it is not generating the kind of consumer growth which would be more healthy.
I think that's a crucial thing to watch. One of the things that China could do to alleviate these imbalances is allow its exchange rate to appreciate against not only the dollar, but against the euro in particular. And it would be in China's own interest to allow this growth in domestic consumption to be helped by a stronger currency. But politically, it's reluctant to do anything that might risk the Chinese export engine.
What about unemployment? I mean, we might have a big return to growth around the world, but Lionel, do you think there are going to be jobs for everybody?
No, I don't. And I think that the issue in 2010 will continue to be how to preserve the jobs that you have. And in that sense, companies are going to be putting a lot of pressure, I think, on the workforce to accept minimal wage increases, if not freezes, throughout the year.
What about inflation? Central banks around the world have taken unprecedented measures to print money effectively through quantitative easing measures. Is there a big risk that prices are going to start rising uncontrollably?
Well, eventually, I think there is a risk, but probably not for a while. And the difficulty that policymakers have is that consumer prices aren't rising. In fact, they've been much more worried about deflation than inflation. And because there's not going to be a lot of wage inflation, quite the reverse, there'll be much greater worries about jobs, and the capacity of the economies in the rich world in particular is still going to be ample, so there'll be downward pressure on prices, if anything. But meanwhile, you have these asset prices rising, possibly worth looking at raw material prices, oil prices. So I think when central banks have to have this conundrum of how to set interest rates in the year ahead, they're going to be thinking, are they storing up problems by keeping interest rates so low for too long?
I'm going to stick my neck out and say that inflation will not be any kind of threat in 2010, maybe even 2011. And the reason is what I said earlier in the programme, which is we're in a period now where consumers are repairing their balance sheets, they're paying down debt, and because of that, there isn't, I believe, substantial risk of inflation.
Now, bankers versus banksters, what do you think, Lionel?
Well, I think that the banksters are going to come out on top. The feeling is that, number one, public outrage will continue against high levels of remuneration for the financial services sector, especially as long as the financial services sector is dependent on implicit guarantees, where the government holds equity stakes in the banks. And if at the same time banks are earning lots of money, large profits, you may well see other countries following Britain on taxes on bonuses and maybe even on Capitol Hill.
Do you see that as a real possibility, Daniel? Crackdown on bankers' pay in the United States. That's always seen as unlikely.
Well, I think there will be political pressure to do it. Remember, it's the midterm elections coming up in America. Bankers are not going to be the most popular of interest group or lobbyists there. So I think it will be tempting, as indeed it has been here, even at the risk of potentially driving some of the industry elsewhere.
Now, it's the turning of a year, but it's also the turn of a decade as we say goodbye to what have come to be known as the noughties and say hello to the rather uninspiring-sounding tens. Briefly, what do you think we're going to be talking about in 2020 as a defining moment of the past 10 years? That's a really tricky one to predict, isn't it?
What we can almost know for sure is that there will be things arising out of the blue that we haven't dreamt of yet. But I think, if anything, the pace of technology is speeding up. And if you couple what's happened not just on the web, but also in biotechnology, for example, and you couple that with extraordinary computing power and the ability to embed computing technologies in things like smart grids, you're going to find huge increases in efficiency in areas that we hadn't dreamt of.
Yes, I think linked to that will be some fascinating changes in the way we work. The notion that work time becomes much more flexible, that people can work from home thanks to these advances in technology. And the second big development, I think, will just be again a tilt towards Asia and increasing importance of countries like Brazil and India.
We'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much to my two guests, Lionel Barber of the Financial Times and Daniel Franklin of The Economist's World in 2010. And a reminder, you can always stay up to date with the latest business news at our website, bbcworldservice.com/business.
The BBC World Service in the United States is distributed by Public Radio International. Distribution is made possible in part by the Medtronic Foundation, working with Teach for America to improve science and math education in communities across the United States. Information available at medtronicfoundation.org.
Next time on The People's Pharmacy, we'll learn about a new approach to overcoming alcoholism.
An old drug used to treat heroin overdose or addiction may offer surprising benefits for alcoholics.
Could naltrexone help people with other sorts of addictions?
Find out on the next People's Pharmacy.
Saturday afternoon at 5.
Coming up in Politics UK, the trickiest issues politicians have to deal with cut across traditional political divides, involving clashes of worldviews and ethical value systems rather than ideology. How to approach assisted suicide, embryo manipulation, designer babies, it's not at all easy. So how's it done? We consult a philosopher, a lawyer and a bioethics watchdog. That's all in Politics UK after a summary of world news.
BBC News with David Austin. A suicide car bomber in northwestern Pakistan has killed at least 70 people and left an unknown number trapped under the rubble of collapsed buildings. Dozens of others were injured in the blast, which occurred near the town of Laki Marwat, close to a volleyball tournament being watched by about 200 spectators. The Somali hardline Islamist group Al-Shabaab has declared that it's ready to send fighters across the Red Sea to support Islamist rebels in Yemen. A top Al-Shabaab official, Sheikh Mukhtar Robo Abu Mansour, made the pledge at a rally on the outskirts of the Somali capital, Mogadishu, where hundreds of the movement's newly trained fighters were on parade. Britain has called an international meeting to discuss how to combat Islamic militancy in Yemen. It follows the alleged attempt to blow up an American airliner on Christmas Day by a young Nigerian who's thought to have been trained in Yemen by Al-Qaeda. The Iraqi government says it will vigorously pursue court action against five security guards from the American company Blackwater, who were accused of killing 17 unarmed civilians in Baghdad in 2007. A spokesman called a decision by a judge in the US to dismiss charges against the men unacceptable and unfair. Iran's opposition leader Mir Hussein Mousavi has said the country is in a serious crisis and that the arrest or death of opposition leaders, including himself, would not calm the situation. Heavy rain and landslides in the Brazilian state of Rio de Janeiro have killed at least 30 people. Several were buried when a luxury guest house at a tourist resort was swept away. And the authorities in China have shut down a dairy in Shanghai after some of its milk products were found to be tainted with the industrial chemical melamine, which was at the centre of a nationwide food safety scandal in 2008. Three managers were arrested. BBC News.
BBC.
BBC.
Welcome to Politics UK from the BBC. I'm Dennis Sewell. Many of the most bitterly contested issues that Britain's legislators have to deal with these days involve complex ethical questions. But does the country have a generally accepted ethical framework within which to consider these problems? Or are questions about assisted suicide, genetic engineering, and the manipulation of human embryos interpreted very differently from diverse cultural standpoints? And if they are, how should politicians resolve them? These are the questions that we're examining on Politics UK this week. I'm joined by Lord Faulkner, who as Lord Chancellor under Tony Blair was in charge of the judiciary, by Lisa Jardine, the Chair of the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, and by John Haldane, Professor of Philosophy at St Andrews University in Scotland and Director of that university's Centre for Ethics, Philosophy and Public Affairs. John Haldane first. When it comes to the sort of issues that I've just listed, do we have in Britain today commonly agreed assumptions that everyone or almost everyone shares? Anything like a set of ethical default settings?
I would say yes. There's a residue of, in part of Judeo-Christian thought, which itself builds on Greek ethical thought, but also of Enlightenment thought. So I'd say there were sort of three elements that are widely accepted. One is that deliberation about policy should involve welfare, regard for welfare or well-being. Secondly, that it should have regard for autonomy or individual liberty. And third, that there should be equality of regard. Having said that, although that provides a foundation, it's very far from being sufficient for resolving these contested matters. And that's where different and distinct and perhaps incompatible ethical perspectives come into play.
How does that work in debate in the House of Lords, Lord Faulkner?
Well, I think we now lack a unifying religious basis for our society, and the sorts of issues that you've described, assisted suicide, genetic engineering, the exact extent of human rights, are now all up for grabs because the ethical framework which John Haldane described is so loose that it provides no solution to those issues, whereas previously a religious basis for our society did provide the answer to those questions.
Lisa Jardine, on the front line at the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, does it seem like that?
What's so interesting is I love listening to John Haldane and Charlie Faulkner's
account, that is where we sit. But of course, where I sit, which is making decisions about assisted reproduction, those issues simply have to be resolved. And I am aware on a day-to-day basis, for instance, of the faith issues of different constituent groups, all of whom have equal access to our decision-making powers, but for whom the resolution of a particular issue, such as to whom will assisted reproduction be given, to whom will donor sperm and eggs be given, and from what source, all of those issues require us to take a decision and will not be regarded as acceptable or even consistently regarded by the groups that we serve.
And that's why, in a way, and it's a very good example, instead of it being dealt with upon a search for basic ethical conclusions, it's handed over to a separate body and all the difficulties are handed over to Lisa's committee. And what she is trying to do is not investigate a philosophical ethical truth, but try and politically, I assume, match a number of conflicting views.
Let's have a look at one of those questions that's had to be considered recently. Lisa Jardine, the question of the access of single women to in vitro fertilisation. Now, there are arguments there of people saying that women have particular rights over their own fertility and that children may have putative rights to have fathers, for instance. How did that argument pan out?
Well, we are mindful that in that situation, for starters, we have the woman seeking assisted reproduction and we have the potential offspring, and they both have rights. The child's position, which we considered very stringently, came down to the fact that a child had a need for a supportive environment. So the needs of a child were detached from the need for a father, which were argued, interestingly, not to be appropriate to certain, for instance, social groups. There are groups with extended families for whom it's not appropriate to consider that a father has to be present. So in the discussion, it was agreed that for the new law, which is what you're talking about, we removed the phrase need for a father and replaced it with supportive parenting.
John Haldane, do you think that this was considered in the right way?
Well, I think in one sense, bodies like the HFEA are in an almost impossible position. Lord Falkland mentioned what's becoming, I suppose, really the habit of Parliament creating statutory bodies which then have attached to them the responsibility of implementing various aspects of law and so on. And I think it's right that to some extent Parliament should defer this across. But where it touches upon absolutely fundamental questions, as indeed this issue does, Parliament is the right place to try to sort of resolve, to the extent that these matters can resolve, the fundamentals of these. And that, indeed, is what happened with regard to the debates around this legislation. But could I just say, I think that what the HFEA and other bodies in similar areas or in other areas have sometimes tried to do is to work towards a sort of pragmatic conclusion, arriving at a kind of compromise, recognising that there are strong opinions in opposing directions, let's say, and then trying to look for some resolution in the middle. That can look as if it's a bit unprincipled, but in fact it seems to me as a part of reality that that's going to be an element. You simply will reach a point at which you have to just try to arrive at some sort of compromise.
John, sorry, can I just say, I wouldn't like that to be on the record as the way that we do reach decisions, because we actually at some point have to agree that there are some groups that cannot be satisfied in this instance. And that's a very, very tricky thing to do as a national body. But were we to compromise, as you say, I don't think we'd reach satisfactory decisions.
And you're also missing what seems to me to be the fundamental point, the setting up of an organisation that can make decisions about genetics fundamentally accepts that spiritual objections are not to be accepted. Because if the spiritual objection was to be accepted, then Lisa's body couldn't agree to half the things that she agreed to.
She does actually have a bishop on it, doesn't she?
Well, bishop Richard, as was Bishop Richard Harris, Lord Harris, actually steps down this very week and will be sorely missed. I should say, by the way, that we're often accused of not having representatives of other faiths. We don't ask anybody what their faiths and beliefs are. I can tell you, however, I do happen to know there have been Catholics on the HFEA and there are people of other persuasions. It is absolutely true that we are unable to use the spiritual arguments to guide us because of the diversity of the British population.
Okay, yeah. Let's just take that on then, because let's have a look at things where, you know, what kind of arguments therefore can you consider on these more tricky things? Let's go on to another one that you have been looking at, the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD, where an embryo is examined under a microscope and checked to see if it has any defects, and if it is seen to have genetic defects, discarded. Now, what rules can you apply to that about what are the legitimate reasons for discarding?
Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is a procedure that is undertaken in a very rare set of circumstances. All examples are listed on the HFEA website, in which there is a known condition on a single gene which can be identified, the consequent of which is devastating disease. We have licensed a very restricted number of conditions for which we agree you may look at embryos under the microscope to identify embryos which do not have that genetic defect. So, of course, this means that if there are some that do, they are set aside. However, it is by no means certain there will be one. And yes, then you're right, then they are allowed these 10 cell conglomerations, then they are allowed to cease to exist. I believe, and I think I'm speaking for the HFEA, that in the very small number of cases in which we allow that, most of the population, whatever their set of beliefs, would agree that the suffering to the family and the child, and particularly the family that knows they have a predisposition for this condition, mitigates the 10 cells discarded.
At the moment, this sort of technology is in its infancy, Lord Faulkner, but it won't be in 10, 20 years' time. And people will be asking then questions like, well, if I want a daughter rather than a son, or if I want a blue-eyed child rather than a brown-eyed child, why shouldn't I be able to choose it if the technology is there to allow choice?
Because it feels like it's going much, much too far. The circumstances in which Lisa justified the setting aside of embryos before implantation seems to me to be sensible, it seems to me to be right. The idea that one should be looking at embryos, if it's possible to do this, to see what IQ your children would have, what colour of eyes have, is going much, much too far and would not be acceptable to the population.
They seem too far now, but won't people feel a duty to do the best for their children? And as you say, if they ever do find the gene for intelligence and people can spot that it's there, won't they feel that they have to pursue this kind of technology in order to do the best for their children?
That doesn't reflect decent people's views at the moment. That doesn't feel decent or right to me, though moods might change in relation to it. But that's not what I feel the right response would be.
John Holden.
I was going to say, I mean, isn't this really just the point that this sort of appeal to intuitions, what decent people might feel now and that might change, and what I feel and what somebody else might feel and so on, while I understand the role that plays in one's individual thinking, it can't really be a secure foundation for trying to address these fundamental questions. And I think there's a, you know, in the discussion up to this point, there's been a recognition that we are dealing with rather charged ethical issues. So when Lisa says, for example, allowed to cease to exist, somebody else is going to say, what do you mean, destroyed? Now, I think, understandably, that this sort of delicacy is a response to the recognition that we are dealing here with very fundamental values. What are those values? Well, the status of human life. And there is something that I think we need to think more about. There has been a tendency, I think, to drift from the idea that life has some sort of value in and of itself, to the thought that the value that a life has is the value that's realized in it, if you like, the quality of that life. Now, the danger of the second view is that it does begin to license a kind of commodification of life. So you start to make judgments along the lines of, well, I wouldn't want to live a life like that. And I think there the danger is that we move from some principled foundation rooted in a conception of what a human life is to
vague intuitions about what one thinks at this time would constitute a decent kind of life or not.
You're not offering anything, John, by that. You're simply identifying the difficulty.
And I also think you've twice used the word intuition. Women particularly balk. The word intuition is always used to suggest that there is not logical reasoning behind what's arrived at. And that simply isn't the case in circumstances like this. I should just pop in the fact that it is illegal to have sex selection by British law, so that's fine. But the other thing I need to say to you, which John Haldane will feel is too far from the high-flown general issues, is you need to think, you all happen to be men, but you all need to think about how invasive the procedure is prior to having pre-genetic diagnosis. I think that actually people need things to be very serious before they want to have some kind of genetic screening.
But look, this clearly is a matter of how much people want a certain outcome. I mean, I accept what you've just said, but you might say the same thing about, say, cosmetic surgery, for example. That is to say that one might think that it was very unlikely that people would be willing to subject themselves to the risks and dangers of surgery in order merely to improve their appearance. But the fact of the matter is that we know that this has been a massive area of growth in recent years. And the point is, I mean, I go back to what Lord Faulkner said. He spoke about what decent people might feel now but recognise that this might change in the future. And that, it seems to me, is the danger here, that I'm not against intuitions playing a role, but intuitions have to be tested against something more secure and more solid than merely what one happens to think at this given time or be inclined to feel.
Well, could I just take that point further, Lord Faulkner, and put to you, say that the argument on the other side became stronger. Let's say that the technology moves far ahead of where we are now, and if somebody came to you and said, look, we have discovered ways in which we could not only have get rid of all genetic-based diseases, but also we could design out crime to a large extent. We found that there are certain genetic moral traits, and we could get rid of all the problem ones as well, and improve the whole standard of humanity. It'd be quite hard to resist, wouldn't it?
Oh, I would resist it. It would seem to me to be morally offensive. But I recognise, as John Haldane says, that morals change.
You're listening to Politics UK from the World Service of the BBC with me, Dennis Sewell. I think at this stage, could we move on to another of the great problem issues that have been discussed recently, and that is the one of assisted suicide. What you have been involved in this argument yourself, Lord Faulkner, not something the HFEA has actually had to deal with terrifically, has it, Lisa Jardine? But
interestingly related, I think the end of life and any way we intrude on that process with legislation or with any body that oversees this is absolutely comparable, because that is the extinguishing of life. I have strong views about how we should deal with assisted dying, and the first of them is that you cannot just assemble public opinion on the hoof. You cannot decide what parliamentarians think and decide on the basis of that, or what a few people out in Switzerland do and decide. It is going to require, as with Baroness Warnock's original report on assisted reproduction, it is going to require something much more heavyweight and systematic, I believe, before we can arrive at an agreed moral stance for the time being.
John Haldane.
Of course, it's right to say, as Lisa does, that there's a certain symmetry here in as much as one's dealing with beginning and end-of-life issues. But there's also a very important asymmetry, which is that in the case of end-of-life issues, one's dealing with somebody whose life has been part of the lives of others, caught up in various voluntary and other relationships. But once again, I think that in discussing this issue, it has to be set within a larger framework of some kind of understanding of what a human life is. I don't despair of the possibility of arriving at some consensus around that, by the way. Indeed, for most of human history, there has been a consensus. It wasn't a religious one. I mean, it's rooted in traditions that were not ethical traditions. And indeed, if I could just add one thought, in some respects, actually, the post-religious culture that we inhabit, rather than being a threat to the possibility of finding an ethical foundation, might be thought to open up that opportunity, because we can recover some of the ideas that, you know, were within the Greek world and within the Roman world that were not themselves religious ideas. Those people had well-developed ethical systems that didn't rely on religious ideas. So I don't think we should be fearful that the shifting cultural change with regard to religion somehow disables us from arriving at an ethical foundation.
Bill Faulkner.
In 1961, it was made lawful to kill yourself, but unlawful to assist somebody else to die. What we've seen in recent years is people who desperately want to die Dan James as an example, a person of 21 years old who was paralysed in a rugby accident. His parents sought to dissuade him from killing himself. He insisted that he wanted to die, and eventually they agreed to take him to Switzerland, where it was lawful to have an assisted suicide. The question for our society is, do we want to make what they did a crime? As far as the law is concerned, it could be constructed in a way that such behaviour wasn't a crime, and in a sense leave the ethical questions to one side. By a series of decisions, the law has now reached that conclusion. The House of Lords, it then was, said the Director of Public Prosecutions, who had no stomach for prosecuting people like that, had to make clear what his approach was, irrespective of the terms of a statute, and he's broadly made clear that his approach is that he will not prosecute genuine, compassionate assisters.
Lisa Jardine.
From where I sit, the problem seems to me to be that that still leaves unclarity. The law has not made it clear, and there is no other organisation that could clarify it.
I accept there is still some degree of lack of clarity, but if a law said you can't be prosecuted for assisting suicide if you are a compassionate assister, but you can if you're a greedy or malicious encourager, and broadly the law can make those distinctions in statute, and the jury can decide which side of the line the individual fell, that seems to me to be a perfectly moral and ethical position for the law to take up. And as I understand your disagreement with me, it's saying, well, the way that we've done it is not adequate. I agree with that. I wish it had been a statute.
But I think I'm saying, and I'd pass it to John Haldane, actually. I'd love to put... John,
yeah.
Don't you... I want to hear what you have to say about that, because to me there is a gap there that Charlie Faulkner's not acknowledging.
I think this is an interesting example of a more general phenomenon, which is we can draw a distinction between the personal and individual resolution of a question and ask about the rights and wrongs, goods and bads involved in that, and the matter of a public policy made by, implemented and enforced by law. Now, with regard to assisted suicide, the interesting debate seems to me this one. It's a question of making general law. And the point about law is it doesn't merely, if it makes something permissible, given the general confusion, perhaps to some extent, of the legal and the ethical, people somehow think that this option is legitimised as opposed to merely decriminalised. And this is an area in which I'd be inclined to say that one must be very mindful of the larger effects of changing legislation. You see, as things stand at present, the Director of Public Prosecutions is not required to bring a prosecution. The discretion can be exercised in that matter. If a prosecution is brought, a judge can direct a jury in a certain way. If a jury hears the matter, they can resolve the matter in a certain way. So there are several steps, even within the existing framework, that would allow for no prosecution. But I think if you switch the law the other way round, first of all, it's enormously difficult to formulate a law in those circumstances. But if you were to do so, I think
Lord
it gives a message.
Lord Faulkner's shaking his head, thinks it's easy.
But I think, I just finish this point. I think it gives a message about how, as a society, we regard the treatment of life. That
but
was all I wanted
there's
to
a
say.
Fundamental question, John, which you are totally avoiding in what you've said. Do you think it should be criminal in our society to do as the parents did in the case that I referred to? Everybody who's ever debated the issue, including the DPP, has no stomach to bring criminal proceedings. They don't want that sort of behaviour to be criminal. So shouldn't it be taken out of the criminal law?
But that's just the point. You can have prohibition on this kind of action without choosing to bring a prosecution under the law.
Because you reject the criminal law I know, where people say we don't want to prosecute anybody who did
no, no, but it's not.
But
it's
we
not
make
a question,
it criminal.
Sorry, it's not a question of not wanting to prosecute anybody. It's rather the circumstances. This that one wants to protect vulnerable and innocent people.
Yeah.
Is mindful of the fact, however, that special circumstances may arise. But the better way of dealing with that, at least we've judged this hitherto, the better way of dealing with that is by the exercise that can, the discretion that can be exercised by a prosecutor or by a judge or by a jury in determining as to whether or not they feel that somebody should be penalised in some way for this.
That's a very novel view of the criminal law, which is to say you over-criminalise and then let discretion determine.
All I will say is
And in a way, it's leaving people at the end of their life with very considerable uncertainty as to what will happen to their loved ones if they help them do something which is lawful for them.
But I could just respond to that by saying one has to consider what the implications would be of reversing the situation.
I'd like to move on very briefly just to ask who ought to be involved in all of these discussions. Now, from the way that you've had your discussion today, it would seem that you would welcome a broad swathe of people with different sorts of ideas. In many of these specific instances, there is one voice, and that's the voice of science, which has, to some extent, and increasingly, been arguing that other people should get out of the public square on this sort of issue, and that scientific knowledge and scientific truth and things arrived at by scientific method have precedence over other forms of truth or opinion. Lord Faulkner, what do you think?
Well, absent a religious basis for our society, the only basis which resolves these issues or determines how they should be resolved is ultimately the law. Lisa's body has been set up to deal with the genetic issues. The criminal law deals with issues like assisted suicide. There isn't an accepted ethical body like a church or a religion which determines them. So ultimately, it is the law. It is through the medium of law, ultimately, that society determines how wide the discretion is going to be to do things that spiritual groups might think was unethical.
Lisa Jardine.
The problem with science always has been the scientists pursue the goal of the ultimate outcome in their field. And notoriously, with the splitting of the atom and then eventually the atomic bomb, they are willy-nilly not able to be responsible, let's put it no stronger than that, for possible outcomes of what they do. The geneticists now are working away, absolutely committed to resolving all kinds of problems, solving all sorts of questions in the genetic domain, just as those physicists did in the 1930s, and they have no regard for the ultimate outcome. However, we live in a 100% scientific society. What actually terrifies me is that we have an ethically quite sophisticated public which is completely undertrained in science. And so the question scientists put to us, we are in no position to answer. I see that all the time with the number of experts I have to call in to advise me on issues in genetics. I can follow the argument, because I was actually trained as a scientist. Actually, we do not prepare people in the humanities to be able to follow those arguments, let alone master the data. How are we going? I love the idea that the law will just resolve this. Hooray, the lawyers again.
Ultimately, what the law does is it sets up the parameters within which it will be resolved. So in relation to the genetic issues, it's saying no to any spiritual veto, yes to a variety of considerations which your body then applies.
I fear that's going to mean a large number of quangos who mediate, as we do, between the problem, the law and politics.
But you're not that sort of quango. You are effectively a judicial type of quango.
John Haldane, can the lawyers and the scientists between them sort it out, or do we need philosophers?
Well, I think the point is that scientists, as Lisa has suggested, are innately curious and want to explore possibilities. And so the question is that they're inclined to ask themselves is, what could we do? Whereas what we need to be asking ourselves is the question, what should we do? And science in and of itself isn't going to answer that question. At the same time, we need to be properly informed about the science. And again, I agree with Lisa, there's a high degree of illiteracy. But could I just say finally that an area in which I think we should be looking is the idea of the establishment of something like a National Bioethics Committee that could have partly parliamentary representation on it, but partly people outside. Because we are finding again and again, we need to bring together resources from different departments to understand these things and to try to proceed as best we can on the basis of some common understanding and of those common values that I spoke of earlier of welfare, autonomy and equality.
And we shall have to leave it there. Many thanks to John Haldane, Lisa Jardine and Lord Faulkner. And that brings to an end this New Year edition of Politics UK from the BBC. I'm Dennis Sewell and the editor was Elaine Thomas. Politics UK will be back at the same time next week. Till then.
Sunday afternoon at 5, join us for a live broadcast of Keepin' the Faith. Each week, host Steve Shoemaker and his guests explore issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. This week, Steve's guest is Michael Callahan, author of the book Too Politically Sensitive. Your calls are welcome at 217-333-9455. That's Keeping the Faith, Sunday afternoon at 5.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Delivery is available at 239-5632. Strawberry Fields also offers an in-store nutritionist.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.